Great. Okay. So, second talk on the six paramitas. So we had a really good talk by Dana Badri last week on Dana, the perfection of giving. And so tonight I'm talking about the perfection of ethical practice, Sila Paramita. Yeah. So my starting point is a passage, just a very, very short passage from the beginning, from the introduction of Living Ethically by Sangharakshita. I thought, oh gosh, I need to root around for some fresh inspiration. It's picked up Living Ethically, and after the first couple of pages, this is what I read. The basic principle of ethics, according to the Mahayana, is to help others, whereas the view from the Hinayana is that the practice of ethics is undertaken largely as an exercise in cultivating and preserving positive mental states. The Mahayana does not contradict this viewpoint, but simply regards a wholehearted concern for others as a more positive motivation than a concern for one's own mental states. Another Mahayana certainty is that ethical behaviour is grounded in perfect wisdom, and at the same time that the development of wisdom is only possible on the basis of an ethical life. So I was struck by this assertion that ethical behaviour is grounded in perfect wisdom. So I'm going to return to that theme, and that will be largely the basis of my talk, although I'll range around that. But just to go back to the beginning, the basic principle of ethics is to help others. So in what way? And I think what that means is to be concerned with alleviating suffering. So through one's ethical practice, not causing suffering if you can help it, and to avoid being the cause of suffering and to contribute to the well-being of others. Yeah, so to be kind, to give, and to speak kindly, wisely, and with meaning. Yeah. In the six perfections, if you look at the list of the six perfections, now, there is no perfection of kindness, okay? There's no perfection of metta or compassion, but this isn't an oversight. It's not as if kindness accidentally got left off the list. So why? What is that about? Well, it's not an oversight. It's just that kindness, metta, love, they are the way that you perfect, yeah? And the six perfections themselves, they add up to the Mahakarana, which is synonymous with the bodhicitta. So metta, compassion, kindness, love, that is the way, the manner in which we conduct our ethical training. So that is what the precepts are. They are an ethical training. And in undertaking that training, it's implicit that you're not there yet, that you have some work to do, and that's why you engage to train. So the precepts then, they're not this list of 5 things or 10 things that we look at. We just look at them and we just feel demoralised because, you know, we can't measure up to them. Or, you know, maybe actually you might be of a different character and a disposition, and you might look at the list and you might just go, oh yeah, check. Okay, what's next? So, you know, I've got them under control. Give me something else to do. So if you look at the 5 or the 10 precepts and think you've kind of got them sussed, you've got them taped, then your training is to look deeper. Yeah, to go deeper into your actions, your thoughts and your words and your motivations around those 3 things. But I mean, on the whole, I think hopefully we don't make that particular mistake, because hopefully we can see where there is scope for growth, scope for improvement, where there could be more kindness, maybe less self-reference, less impatience, or, you know, less harsh judgment, where there's room for more insight. Yeah. To go back a bit, though, to the other mistake, if you look at the precepts and you are just overwhelmed by them, or that you feel that you can't measure up, then just simply remembering that it's a training might help, yeah? That you do it a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time, as you can. That may help. So it's not about measuring yourself up to some near impossible standard. And being a training, that means that you take into account that, well, you are being stretched, yeah? You are going against the grain a bit by whether it's being a bit kinder or a bit more generous or whatever. Yeah, you are being stretched in that. So give your, you need to give yourself credit for being willing to enter into the challenge of behaving more like how an enlightened person would act. So it's like how an enlightened person would naturally act, because in a way that's what the precepts give us. It is the way that a Buddha would spontaneously act and interact. So to go back to my opening quote from Sangharakshita, ethical behaviour is grounded in perfect wisdom. That's how a Buddha would behave. So of course it is, yeah? Of course that is how a Buddha would act, an enlightened person would act. For us, if it's not natural or spontaneous just yet, then one thing that we can do, which I think is very helpful, is what I call acting as if. So you don't feel particularly connected with people one day, you don't feel that kind, you don't feel that generous, but what you just do is you just do the thing anyway. Yeah. So you act as if you had metta, or as if you had patience, or whichever the more enlightened attribute happens to be. So you kind of suspend the small mind that you're labouring under at the moment. And what you do is you go for refuge to a bigger, a more compassionate mode of being. Now, it's not being two-faced to act in this way, because you're actively choosing this, yeah? You acknowledge your initial instincts to go, yeah, to shrink back. But then you decide to act in service of a bigger ideal. So that is just one way that we can train. Now, why do we need to practice ethics? Okay, well, we've got this biological inheritance. Our biological evolution has given us, bred into us, you could say, instincts that keep us safe, that have kept us safe. So we've developed an urgent imperative to repel that which is a threat, yeah? And to hold on to and hold in close to comfort and security. Yeah, we've needed to rely on these instincts, and up until now, those instincts have served us well. Yeah, make no mistake, they've served us well. But from the viewpoint of what Sangharakshita calls the higher evolution, these root instincts, they don't serve us so well anymore. Yeah, and they are what the Buddhist tradition calls the three mula kleshas. Yeah, so greed, hatred and delusion, or sometimes that's called craving, aversion and ignorance. So now the thing about these three roots, we've all got them, and there is absolutely no blame in them. You don't have to give yourself a hard time for them, because like I said, they are just kind of part of this, the package that we've evolved with. So there's no blame in the three roots. And, you know, we've evolved from goodness knows what kind of funny squiggly thing into this mammal, which is, you know, probably quite a sophisticated mammal with a DVD player and everything. And that's all okay, but at a certain point, if you want to evolve further, yeah, and well, basically, really what I'm meaning is if you want to practice the Dharma, you have to start uprooting these three mula kleshas, yeah? You have to start deliberately minimizing your stock of this craving, of this aversion, of this delusion. And start systematically building up, working on building up their opposites, yeah? So systematically building up more generosity, more metta, more insight, more instincts to those towards those things, yeah? Now, thankfully, this happens to be an eminently doable task, because these three unwholesome roots are empty, entirely empty by nature, yeah? So they're not solid, they're not fixed, they're not ultimately real. And the good news for us is that they are not an integral part of your being, of my being. Yeah, of they're not an integral part of the person who happens to have them. Yeah? So luckily for us, these three roots arise in dependence upon conditions. Does this sound familiar? They arise in dependence upon conditions. And the good news is that they cease when those conditions aren't around anymore. However, the problem is, if they are left to their own devices, they condition us. That's what they do. They influence us, and they affect our experiences, and they affect how others experience us. But they don't last, and they don't have any inherent existence, as I said. So that's a really good thing, yeah? So we do have to practice, because of them, though, we do have to practice the precepts. We have to train ethically in order to uproot them, yeah, to use the metaphor that they bring a metaphor to the table that they are, you know, they are a root. So we have to uproot them. So we've all inherited these tendencies, as I said. It's a bit like we've kind of moved into a house and discovered it's got dry rot, yeah? And we have to apply then the appropriate antidotes. So that means, again, like I said, it's increasing our stock of metta, of generosity, of insight, and letting that find expression through body, through speech, through mind. And that's basically what practicing ethics is, no? So, these three roots, they are also called the akusala mulas, yeah? So, as I said, mula means root. I called them the mula kleshas, which means the root defilements. But akusala mula, that means the roots of unskillfulness. So I want to look at that terminology. I think it's interesting that they're called akusala mulas because that term applies directly to ethics, yeah? As you know, in Buddhism, an ethical action or state of mind is called kusala, it's called skillful, yeah? And an unethical state of mind is called akusala, unskillful, yeah? So these terms, skillful, unskillful, are very blame-free, yeah? They're just very objective descriptions that something is either skilled or not skilled, yeah? And the skill is in living well. So living in a way that doesn't cause harm or suffering to you or to someone else or to the planet. So if you are avoiding causing harm and suffering, and so cultivating contentment or metta or awareness, then that is skilled, yeah? And if you are causing harm or distress, it's unskilled. It's as simple as that, really. Causing harm and distress is not a very good way to live, yeah? And it is rooted in craving, aversion, and delusion. It's not life-enhancing, so it's unskilled, unskillful. So this is just very, very different from the whole notion of sin. Go back to this Mahayana view that ethical behaviour is grounded in perfect wisdom. So there is one area that has a really direct bearing on, and that is the issue of our self-view. So actually, to say that ethics is grounded in perfect wisdom, all of the paramitas are grounded in perfect wisdom, really, but I realised that as I was writing this, but for now I'm sticking to ethics. So our self-view, well, in order to give like a real fuel to our practice of ethics, we can align ourselves with a really crucial aspect of right view, which is that oneself is not a fixed and unchanging self. That we don't have an inherent essence or core to our being that, and that absolutely everything about us is subject to change, and it will change. It's changing now, yeah? So we have no fixed self, yeah? And that is why we can get enlightened. That is why that we can kind of wriggle our way, kind of wriggle free of these roots, of these mula kleshas. And it's why an ethical practice can help us get off the wheel, get onto the spiral. So we can, because we're not basically fixed and stuck, because everything about us is changing and will change, so then because of that we can become habituated to positive mental states that are part of the spiral. So faith, delight, rapture, tranquility, bliss, samadhi, insight. That's, we're all up for that because we don't have a fixed nature. Past insight, then it's on to disentanglement, dispassion, vimukti, freedom. That's all very good, but I'll calm down, okay? Let's not get carried away. I'm just saying that there is no, this view of no fixed self, to really take that on board, I think really gives fuel, a fuel injection to our ethical practice. And I think it's seeing that is key. So, as I said, there is nothing that can't change. Everything can change, and in fact, it's not from a Mahayana point of view, it's not that things can change, it's that there are no things. Yeah, from the Mahayana point of view. It's not that things can change, it's that there's no things. So in this, there is a crucial misperception that we accidentally perform over and over again. Our idea of thingness, of selfhood, is just a misperception. So again, it's not, you're not like a really bad person, you know, you're not a tube. It's just a trick of the light. Yeah. So it's a misperception, and our idea of self, that's what it is. It's a misperception. It's just that kind of topsy turvy view. So how we relate to ourselves and to most of our experience, it's kind of topsy turvy, because it's like, say we're watching a cartoon, right? Say we're watching Tom and Jerry. That totally gives my, you know, Tom and Jerry gives you age away, doesn't it, when you think Tom and Jerry is a cartoon? Okay, so anyway, we're watching Tom and Jerry, it's all going crazy around the kitchen, and we get really wrapped up in that, and we kind of invest, we emotionally believe it all. And what happens, that's great, that's fine, but we miss that it's a magic lantern show, yeah? We miss that, and we grasp onto it as kind of real. And it's not just that Tom and Jerry is made up of tens and tens of thousands of ink drawings, but really it's all just flickering dots on a screen, yeah? It's just coloured dots flashing. But, I mean, I'm not daft. I know that, like, we don't experience selfhood as, like, coloured dots flashing, because we're intensely emotional beings, yeah? So we get in there with the who's getting chased and who's getting hit with the milk jug, yeah? We get intensely emotionally involved with people, with situations, with fears about the future and regrets about the past and things that cause tensions between people. But from a more enlightened viewpoint, a more enlightened view remembers that it's a magic lantern show. And it's like, if I'm bearing a grudge against somebody because I don't like them or they've criticised me in some sort of a way, from an enlightened point of view, it's a bit like I'm this child crying really heartfelt tears and sobs because my sandcastle has just been washed away by the tide. And this child, who is me, who is all of us, it's like we're heartbroken because of this thing that's happened. But there's this whole amazing beach that we could play on. And there's this whole amazing day that we could play in. There's this whole amazing life that we could play in. But we've kind of missed an opportunity somewhere because we forget that it's just in the nature of the water's edge to creep up and down the shore. Yeah? And so we're breaking our heart about something that's just the play of reality. And there's all this other incredible reality that we're missing. Yeah? So it's like what's happened there is a really over investing in the thingness of that wee sandcastle, and we project a solidity onto the phenomena around us, onto people around us, and we imbue people and things with a permanence that they don't have. Okay? And then what happens? Well, we suffer. Yeah. So to the extent that we imbue things with permanence, we suffer. To the extent that we imbue things with permanence, we suffer. So if we can learn to appreciate the more ephemeral side of things, if we can love things more deeply, knowing that they are ephemeral, then we love with less regret. Yeah? So it's not just that you go, oh yeah, things are impermanent and they have no essence, so I'll just, you know, lean away and cut off and keep myself safe. It's not like that. It's more like if you love something, then love it knowing it's ephemeral. Love it with its ephemeral self, with your ephemeral self, yeah? And we see it more deeply then, yeah? So we don't just see the surface anymore, yeah? We see its fragility and its wholeness, which means that we see its emptiness. So this is kind of where I got to in my reflections about ethical behaviour grounded in perfect wisdom. So, you know, applying the emptiness to oneself, it means that you see that you're not fixed. And Sangharakshita says this really great thing about this in The Taste of Freedom. He's talking about no self in this way. He says, the Buddhist doctrine of anatta, or no self, does not so much mean that we never have a self as that we always have a new self. So again, we're back to all the possibilities on that beach in that day. Yeah, we always have a new self. So, I mean, this makes perfect sense from an experiential point of view, because we all experience a self, don't we? Nobody, you know, I mean, you have to be in quite a bad state to experience, to wake up and think there's no self. So experientially, there is something happening, yeah? But that it's always new, yeah? And it's always replete with possibility. And it's not made up of this solid thingness. There's a fluidity about us that's ultimately empty, which means that it is full of possibilities. So seeing past the surface and seeing at a deeper level, that helps us get a handle on this anatta, this lack of fixed self. And that's what's involved in the breaking of the first of the 10 fetters. So breaking the 10 fetters is an earlier way from the Mahayana. It's an earlier way of looking at gaining enlightenment. And if you break the first 3 fetters, then you've developed the basis for transcendental insight. Yeah. So the first 3 fetters are fixed self-view, which is what I've been talking about. Doubt, and this is doubt, great word, vichikitsa. Good, but you don't want that as a name. Don't get ordained to get called vichikitsa, that's not. Okay, even though it sounds kind of Russian and sexy. So it's doubt, and it's doubt think about it like wobbling and vacillating. It's like the opposite of commitment. You know, so it's doubt that's vacillating, and it's kind of grounded on muddy thinking. And the last of the 3 fetters is observance in ethical and moral codes as ends in themselves. So again, it's taking things on the surface. Sangharakshita calls that fetter. He's rendered it as superficiality. So if you break those 3, fixed self-view, vichikitsa, doubt, and seeing through rites and rituals as ends in themselves, then that's the kind of basis of transcendental insight stream entry. So all of this business about fixed self-view is, I think of that as being like part of the big picture. But I want to just kind of focus in a bit, maybe on detail, on maybe a few specifics. So I remembered a particular view. I remember hearing a friend saying this, and I found it really painful. It's an attitude that it's probably not even a very conscious attitude, and it has a voice that says, I don't really have an effect. Yeah. I don't have an effect. So I don't know if you recognise this. You might recognise it in yourself, or you might see it at work in someone else. It might sound fairly blameless. I don't know if that sounds alright. I don't really have an effect. Anyway, even that view itself, the view I don't have an effect, that view is busy having an effect. Yeah, it's conditioning you. It's giving a vibe off to other people as well, a bit of a confusing vibe too. I'll say more about confusing later. It influences their behaviour and their speech around you because they're picking something up. And at its root, I don't have an effect. It's a lack of self-worth that is a manifestation of the delusion, klesha. But it's also mixed up with lack of self-worth, so it's also mixed up with aversion as well. I don't have an effect. It's an absence of metta for yourself. And, well, we do know that the presence of metta always has some kind of positive effect, and it's a skillful state of mind. So then it's worth considering what effect that this opposite of a skillful state of mind will have. Yeah. So to other people, this state of mind might look like, you know, you thinking, I don't really have an effect. That to them might just look like boredom, like you're bored, that there's a kind of disinterest. But it's interesting to look at actually what is really a bit of a kind of a lack of self-worth in you, a crisis in self-worth, sending out confusing messages because it looks like something else. And it's hard for other people to read that and then really respond appropriately. So rather than actually seeing your pain, the other person is more likely to feel alienated and judged by what looks like your boredom and your indifference or your disdain. Yeah. So this is just a small little thing. Maybe it sounds kind of petty and wee, but I'm interested in, I kind of want to just focus a bit more on small little nuggets of negativity, because I think, well, if they belong to that root tendency of delusion, then they belong to that root tendency of delusion, which means that our bigger delusion is based on all those little bits. So I think small things that we think aren't really of much consequence or that other people can't really pick up on, I think we mistakenly assume that these states are kind of invisible, yeah? That really only we know about them. So I think this delusion, this habit of this root of deludedness, I think if we chip away at its wee tiny manifestations, the tiny specks of it, then I think, well, I hope that ultimately that undermines the big delusion that keeps us separate from everyone else. So I was thinking about these kind of little kind of mean things that we do, little kind of totally unskillfulnesses that we think aren't really important. I was thinking of them as shabby. You know, I mean, they're not terrible, but they're a bit shabby. And it's like, you know, they're not very tidied up side of us. It's a bit grubby. It's like, you know, when you hang around the house in your old pyjamas sort of thing. It's all, you know, it's kind of quite comfortable for you, but you're not going to present that to somebody who you want to impress. So this little shabby side, actually, I think this is a good place to start looking at the perfection of ethics. Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily up in the big showcase things, you know. Because like I say, it's tapping away at this, it's undermining hopefully these roots. So little kind of shabby things, holding on to even enjoying feeling irritated with somebody, you know. More on that later. You know, there's something about them that you don't like, so you kind of almost like the feeling of being annoyed with them. Or, you know, there's nobody else around, you're just sitting in front of the TV and you're just eating too much, or you're drinking a glass of wine, and it's just like you just want to kind of zone out, you know. You just, what you want to do is you want to dull down and kind of numb out a bit, you know. I mean, so what? It's not terrible. You know, maybe you've got a friend or like a wee group of friends, and you go out with those friends, and maybe drink a bit more with those friends than you would do with your like proper Buddhist friends, you know, your kind of Sunday friends. Now, I mean, these are not like, this is not gross ethical misconduct. These are not like travesties of morality, you know? So why am I interested in them? You know, there's something about letting yourself off the hook that I'm interested in. It's this view that these things don't really matter and that they don't really have an effect. I think that's why I'm focusing on them. I think the idea that these little shabby things they don't really matter, they don't have an effect, they probably condition us much more strongly than we think, because they're kind of getting under the wire. They're getting under the wire of our ethical sensibility and their habit forming. So I remember one time I was doing the Metta Bhavana, and I was taken aback by my response to somebody in this fourth stage of the Metta Bhavana. I found it quite shocking because, okay, it was somebody who I was just a bit irritated with and somebody who I was used to feeling a bit irritated with. And it felt quite mild. But actually what it was when I looked at it, I really didn't want to give it up. Yeah, I had this feeling, and I was identified with it, you know, it was like grasping. And I know we all do it, but I was putting myself above that other person so I could look down on them. And I was just so attached to having disdain for them. I really didn't want to let go of that aversion. I really didn't. And I realised that I didn't want to let go of it because it was defining me there and then. You know, I kind of had a role. I was somebody in that bit of the Metta Bhavana. That's really gross, isn't it? But it was like, it felt solid, you know, it felt real. And I had status in that aversion. And if I shifted that, if I gave all that up, then it's like, whoa, not safe. Who the heck am I if I give up my aversion to this person? And it was just too open. It was too open-ended, and it was threatening to relinquish that viewpoint. So I had to just go back, had to pull way back to just really basic metta for myself. Metta for myself as the person grasping onto a little petty dislike and building a character around it, building a self. You know, it was petty and it was one of the small shabby ones that you think don't really matter. But it ran deep, yeah? And it went much, much deeper than I would have ever given it credit for. So, in the small delusion, in the small aversion or craving, I suspect there actually lies something quite deep. Which is why I'm saying that in the shabby, I think is a good place to train in the perfection of ethics. So, a lot of energy goes into these little things, into defining us, to creating a self-view with lots of minute ways. And if we challenge that, a lot of energy, what I discovered in that Metta Bhavana, a lot of energy rises up to defend that habit that looked innocuous. It's like a dragon that was like sleeping in a cave in the dark, and I accidentally poked it. It's like, so just as in all of the precepts, the key value is kindness. Yeah, that's what leads our ethical practice. The key value is kindness. Well, so too with working with ourselves, with wanting to transform ourselves and become more skillful. The key value, or even the key tool to touching into these little shabbinesses is these little compromises. They're compromises, aren't they? The key tool for oneself is metta, it's self-love, and it's encouraging oneself with a kind of gentle kindness. You know, you're not putting the searchlight on and go, right, come out, you know, it's not like a raid, okay? Developing ethically is not like a raid on all your garbage, okay? So you're encouraging yourself, like I said, with a gentle kindness, with a warmth, with a humour, because what you want to gradually build up is confidence. Yeah, confidence that you can train. Yeah, the faith to take more risks and to hold on less tightly to this fixed self. So we need metta in order to change and in order to be more skillful. So I kind of realised I couldn't give this talk without talking about confession. Tried to wriggle out of it, pulled me back in. Can't really talk about Sila Paramita without going into confession. And I don't know how much of you have an experience of the practice of confession, but at a certain point in your Buddhist life, in your Buddhist practice, it kind of becomes unavoidable. So it becomes possible to put a positive light on it. It becomes possible because what happens is you're going along and then you just someday the conditions come together and you find yourself in touch with a momentum, more of a momentum of going for refuge. So what does that mean? It's like a sense of what's attractive about the ideal, the beauty of the ideal strikes you. And it becomes much more important for you then automatically to shed the little petty unskillfulnesses that are holding you back from moving more closer to that ideal. And so you shed them by wanting to make them more conscious. And you put them out there, yeah? And you put them out there by acknowledging them and revealing them to another person. And a good thing happens at that point, which is that if you are sincere about not wanting to carry on with whatever it is the thing that you're confessing, whatever the behaviour, so then if in the light of this more positive ideal that you've gotten in touch with, if you're happy to give up that behaviour, then you become more, you sort of become disidentified with that behaviour. And it's a funny thing happens. It's like in the owning of the unskillfulness, it kind of becomes less a part of you. Yeah? So you objectify it and then it's easier to put it down and you're no longer defined by it. So it's almost like something a bit contradictory seems to happen. You own it, you see it, you own it, you call it by its name, and then it's less you anymore. It's not you. It's like Rumpelstiltskin. You know, when you call him by his name, and he gets out of Dodge, yeah. So it's like it stops being self through the act of confession. So in order for this to work, though, you also have to feel regret at having done whatever it was, and you need to resolve that you don't want to do it again, or at least you say you don't want to do it again, but what if it's like irritation? What if it's ill will? So, you know, chances are it may crop up again. So, you know, in that case, it's like you're willing to want to change and to stop investing in it, if it's ill will or whatever, investing in that way of being. So probably the best way of doing that is what you have to do is you want to practice consciously more the positive part of the precept as well. Yeah. So if you're confessing ill will, it's probably obvious that at some point bringing in more of a sense of loving kindness. So, and like I said, something isn't really a confession if you don't regret it. There's something about you want to put that behaviour behind you and give it up. Yeah. So there's two very interesting mental states associated with confession that I just want to mention. They're very uncomfortable. They're very uncomfortable mental states, but they are entirely positive. So that's interesting. Uncomfortable, but thoroughly positive. And they're found in this list of the 11 positive mental events. You might well have heard of them. They're hri, which you could call shame, and apatrapya, which is respect for wise opinion. Just say a little bit about them. So hri, in Pali it's hiri, which is nice as well, but again, no, that's good. You get called hiri, that's quite good. No, it sounds like hairy. No. Okay, hri. Hri is when our ethical sensibility, it's like our sensitivity to right and wrong, it gets touched off and we sort of instinctively know that we've done something that feels like we've just let ourselves down a bit. It's like ethically there's a disturbance in the force, yeah? And you feel that sensitivity is touched off, and then you know that you have something to confess. You just know it. Kind of comes, your chickens come home to roost there. And it could be felt quite strongly, or it could just feel reasonably mild. And as I said, it probably will feel a bit unpleasant at best, and at its most full-blown, it might feel ghastly. But it's really just a sense of, oh, God, I fell into that. Oh, no. No, no, no. And it's not guilt, yeah? It's not guilt, because it's clear, yeah? It's pure. So it's just a sense of shame at having acted from a smaller part of yourself at a time when a bigger part of you is trying to burst through. And it's not guilt, it's not irrational, it's quite objective. It's like you've objectively done something that's a bit rubbish. Yeah. So, and it leads to confession. It gives rise to purification. So purification, what is that? What is purification? I was thinking about purification today in sort of slightly simple terms. If something is pure, it's unmixed. Yeah? So it's clear and it's integrated. Yeah, I think that's what pure in this context means. So a purification doesn't mean that you get some blessing from the Buddha for being good. He doesn't, like, you don't get a benediction, you know, down on you in nice light. It's like it purification is just that your motive, your intention, your action, it's unmixed, meaning it's all positive. Yeah, it's all positive. It's not mixed up with negative emotions. So that's what Vajrasattva is. Yeah, Vajrasattva is pure because he's kind of fresh and unmixed. He's not mixed up. He's not tainted with something negative. So if you don't have this shri, if you don't feel this shri, it means that you don't really care about the effect that your actions have. You don't care about the effect they have on you or on other people. And the opposite of shri is another great word, ahrikya. Apatrapya, quick thing about that. Apatrapya is kind of similar, but it's got more of a collective sense in, well, it's respect for wise opinion. So it means that you feel kind of checked and you check in with what you know a more spiritually wise person would, just how they would naturally respond. So it might stop, so this apatrapya, it might actually stop you in acting in a way that a more enlightened friend would avoid, you know? So it's kind of this respect for wise opinion, it's apatrapya, it's natural, it's positive, respectful. It's not like a small, creepy, paranoid, oh no, Suryavangsa will give me into trouble if I do that. You know, it's kind of small and gremlin-y. I mean, if it was me, he probably would give me into trouble. Yeah. it's more like knowing that a wise friend would just feel regret if they saw you getting stuck in that. Yeah. And they would see that and they just go, oh, it's a shame. That's a shame. So apatrapya, it either stops you doing that unskillful thing, or as soon as you've done it, you think, oh, no, 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 no. And it kind of pulls you up so that you want to confess it and that you want to resolve not to do it again. So there's that episode in Jane Austen's Emma. You all know the one, yeah? So they're out on the picnic. Emma's all having her head turned by Frank Churchill, who's got the patter. And so she says something really bitchy to this poor wee Miss Bates, who's just a bit of a wee soul. And she just says something a bit bitchy because she can, because it's cheap. And Mr. Knightley comes up to her and he goes, badly done, Emma. And she resists it. She's not having it, you know, because she's been hanging out with Frank Churchill. She's not having it. But then as he kind of hammers it home to her, that was badly done, Emma. It was like it breaks over her. Ugh. So, I mean, she actually, in a way, that's an example of her not quite managing apatrapia. But Mr. Knightley comes in and stands up for apotropia by going, "Badly done, Emma." And it's great, really. It's kind of a moment of... it's like painful, and it's a moment of growth for her. So, yeah. So when might you practice confession? Yeah. Sometimes you might just have some kind of peer group where it's easy. I've got an order chapter. Some people have got groups, what they call going for refuge groups, where they meet up. And, you know, that might seem like a positive, safe environment to practice confession. But if you don't have an obvious context for it, well, you know, how do you do it? What do you do? Well, something that I've done is that if I've gone on retreat, even like, say, like a weekend retreat, I've just like, I've looked out for somebody on the retreat who is a friend or somebody who I like, and I've got a bit of a natural rapport with. And then if something crops up on that retreat, then I've actually just gone to them and said, "Look, can I just say something?" And I've just done it, bold as you like. So, I mean, I don't know, that might sound like from Mars. It might seem a bit weird or a bit exposing. But I bet if you went up to somebody on a retreat, right, if you went up to somebody on a retreat and said, "Look, I just want to let go of something and it's not about you and I thought it might just help if I confessed it," I bet the smart money is on that if you did that, it would go well. Yeah. And it would go well for both of you and it would probably have a transformative effect on both of you. I don't know. It's just, I'm just saying. I think you might both be changed by it. But anyway. So, I'm going to wrap up. I think that is probably enough. I'm going to recap. I've said quite a lot. I've talked about the practice of the precepts being an ethical training. And I talked about being, you know, this thing that I was sparked off in the initial quote about ethical behaviour being grounded in perfect wisdom, yeah, being grounded in the emptiness of all phenomena. And I talked about the mulakleshas, and our stock of craving, aversion and delusion, which thankfully are empty by nature. And then I talked about working with the kind of small grubby habits, which you might find that they contain more energy and momentum than at first you realised. I talked about confession and about Hri and apotropia. So I started by saying that this basic principle of ethics, according to the Mahayana, is to help others. That was Sangharakshita's premises. In the Mahayana, the basis of ethics is to help others. So I'm going to leave you with some words of advice from Dardo Rinpoche, which is simply this. If you don't know what to do something for others.